Damn, VG, you made this.
Glamorous six-figure salary. Got not one, not two, but 3 degrees. Executive title at my corporation. Prestigious Ivy degree, top education. Turned on the TV, had a long day at work. Police brutality, protests, everyone berserk. Had to turn it off, too much to see. I thought it might be more productive if I read. What's this, Prosperity Now posted a new report? Oh, it's about black people, this definitely can't fall short. The Road to Zero Wealth, that's an interesting title. But if it's about my people and money, it's vital. Uh-oh, yet another negative note. They're saying by 2053 we'll all be broke. By 2053, the median worth of black Americans is set to be murked. Hold up, back up, let me explain wealth. It's more than nice cars, a big house, and good health. You wanna learn more? You better stick around. Zero net worth by 53's not going down.
Started from the bottom, got a slow start. Now we're getting educated, trying to spend our money smart. Let's prove this news, that's all so saddening. And make sure by 2053 it's not happening. Started from the bottom, got a slow start. Now we're getting educated, trying to spend our money smart. Let's prove this news, that's all so saddening. And make sure by 2053 it's not happening.
Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to the first episode of this four-part series about navigating a career in finance with 2053 Edutainment. My name is Amira Pravad-Yizer. I'm a corporate finance attorney at Sidley Austin LLP, which is a corporate law firm located in Midtown Manhattan. And in case you're new to the 2053 fam, which stands for Financially Aware Members, 2053 Edutainment is a podcast and show owned by Amedro Productions Incorporated, designed to educate urban America on how to build wealth, how to learn about finance, and increase their net worth. It was created out of inspiration from the Road to Zero Wealth article published by Prosperity Now and the Institute for Policy Studies, which claimed the median wealth of Black Americans will fall to zero. Yes, zero, by 2053 if current trends continue. Each episode is based on a financial topic where we discuss the matter based on our personal experience, our work experience, and the latest research. We'd usually meet in person, but due to the pandemic, this episode will be virtual. It's a conversational panel-style environment where I'll moderate and lead the discussion on various subjects related to the episode's topic. The first episode of this four-part series is about educational requirements for a career in finance. Here to help us discuss the matter are Jared Dawson, an associate at Morgan Stanley, and Devin Smith, an analyst. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being a part of our first episode. Jared, let's start with you. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, things like where you're from, where you went to school, and what you like to do to de-stress?
Yeah, for sure. So I am from a small town in upstate New York near West Point, about an hour and a half outside of New York City. And for college, I went to Villanova University, graduated in 2015, majoring in economics. From there, shortly after graduating, I began my career at Morgan Stanley. I can delve more into that now. You're also what I do to de-stress. So, I mean, I like hanging out with friends, enjoy reading. Mostly those things, just anything just to take my mind off of not directly work. Okay. And I think it's really important just to have this separate.
Right. Any good book recommendations?
Let's see, what am I reading right now? I'm reading a couple books right now, so like it's kind of jumping places. One book, finished finance book, Ray Dalio, Principles. I'm in the middle of another book called The Turner House. It's about an African-American family in the South. They've really centered around this home in which they all grew up in, and it's like kind of delves into like as the family members get older, you have different members of the family who have different opinions on the house, and whether some have like sentimental value, whether others say like house they should sell it, the burden they have like other family. So it's interesting, and I think it often speaks to how it plays out often a lot in American community.
All right, excellent. And Devin, where are you from? What do you like to do to de-stress, and where'd you go to school?
Yeah, so a little bit of background about myself. I'm from Philadelphia. Went down to Morehouse College for 4 years, where I majored in business finance. I graduated from there in 2018. Things that I like to do in terms of in my free time and to de-stress, I've been pretty active recently. I've been trying to exercise a little bit more and been playing a lot of tennis and riding the Peloton quite a bit. Some other two new things that I've been picking up in quarantine. I also enjoy socializing and hanging out with friends. It's a little bit difficult right now, but it's something that I enjoy to do when I do have the ability to do so. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of two things I do outside of, to de-stress outside of work. Unfortunately, work does take up the majority of my time nowadays, but when I do have some free time, it is nice to do those activities.
Okay, great. And you mentioned your group. Can you just kind of explain, one, what your group does, or like the central focus, yep, and then your position and what that actually means within the structure of your company?
So if you think about traditional private equity.
Private equity, an alternative investment class of capital that is not listed on a public exchange. It is composed of funds and investors that directly invest in private companies or engage in buyouts of public companies.
That's the buying and selling of companies, hopefully improving them through operational and structural changes, and then ultimately realizing some sort of gain when you're selling the business later on. In the secondary private equity group, instead of looking at individual companies, we're looking at interests in funds. So we're purchasing limited partnership stakes in existing private equity funds. So if you think about it from just an easy example, let's say you are a large pension fund or endowment, you inherently have some sort of allocation of private equity funds, whether that's $100 million, $1 billion, whatever it may be. Those investments that you make in these private equity funds on a primary basis are relatively illiquid. So usually your money is locked up for 10 to 12 years, if not longer. And what our role is to provide liquidity in a relatively illiquid market. So in year 5, year 6, year 7, you say, okay, I'm no longer interested in having, you know, this $50 million equity check with this primary manager. You can say, okay, we'll come to strategic partners. They'll underwrite the value of that limited partnership interest and we'll ultimately acquire it from you, usually at a discount, and ultimately take over ownership in that private equity fund as a limited partner. So we'll be responsible for all future cap calls and distributions, but we'll also be entitled to all future gains on that fund. And so the idea behind it is you limit the blind pool risk. So you come in after the private equity fund has already invested the majority of their capital. It's a shorter duration investment. So generally speaking, the IRRs are higher.
IRRs, internal rates of return, a metric used in financial analysis to estimate the profitability of potential investments.
Because instead of having a 12-year lifespan of a private equity fund, you're now shortening it to 7 to 8 years, possibly. And so generally speaking, it's an IRR play, quicker money back. We have similar private equity-esque returns with a lower risk profile. In terms of what I do on my day-to-day, I'm an investment professional on the team, so I'm actually doing a lot of the underwriting for these limited partnership interests, figuring out what all these things are worth and how they factor into our overall portfolios that we're looking at. Usually it's not just one limited partnership interest in a deal. It's often anywhere from two to a deal that I was on 450 limited partnership interests. And we have to have a vested view on all of those different interests and figure out how it aggregates to a total portfolio price. So I do a lot of underwriting, a lot of financial modeling, a lot of sort of projecting and assumptions, and ultimately try to drive value for our group and for our ultimate investors, our LPs as well.
Wow. So Jared, please let us know. I believe you are an associate. Is that the correct title?
So I'm an associate, and I so just a little background myself. So I began working in the operations group at Morgan Stanley. So I did that, working in a couple different groups for about 3 years or so. Then I transitioned internally to a new role working within the finance department. And I work in financial planning and analysis. And in that role, I do a lot of work regarding the balance sheet.
Balance sheet, a financial statement that reports a company's assets, liabilities, and shareholders' equity at a specific point in time.
And P&L.
P&L, profit and loss statement, a financial statement that summarizes the revenues, costs, and expenses incurred during a specified period, usually a fiscal quarter or year.
Really working with senior management to help really understand a lot of the financial metrics to really understand where the firm is currently positioned and where we want to go into the future. So it's really a lot around forecasting, budgeting, a lot of expense analysis in terms of important capital metrics like return on equity, what we do to grow certain areas of the business, where what areas of the business are shrinking. And so it really just involves a lot of day-to-day analysis of that size and scope. So it's been, yeah, so that's kind of really what mainly what my role now.
Excellent. And in case anyone's also been living under a rock, Morgan Stanley, huge multinational investment firm. It's based in Midtown Manhattan.
Correct.
Powerful company. So thank you so much. So tell me a little bit about your college experience. Jared, you mentioned you went to Villanova.
Yep.
And when you're talking about your college experience, because I went to University of Pennsylvania in Philly, not too far from Villanova.
Mm-hmm.
So we partied a lot together. We used to call it Vanilla.
Yep.
It was a predominantly white institution. And when I say predominantly, overwhelmingly. So can you just tell us a little bit about your college experience and when you do speak to the diversity of the institution?
So my college experience, it was definitely something that the reputation, that name is definitely well known by those who current students, future students, past students. That definitely, it's no secret. And it was definitely something that I was incredibly nervous about going there, and I was kind of on the other end of the spectrum. I was really like a toss between going to Villanova or Howard. I don't know how things played out, but it ended up at a complete other end of the spectrum. But the issue of diversity on campus is definitely something that is extremely prevalent. You notice it as you get there. You notice it as you're talking to the members of your fellow class as well as upperclassmen. Students come from different backgrounds. They talk about, I don't know, going to Colorado every year for ski trips and whatnot. And it's like things that I would never even think experienced people that's there part of the regular conversation. So it was definitely a feeling that was very uncomfortable and something that it took me several years to get used to. But I think that in terms of my experience, what really made the difference to me is really finding a sense of community in that. That there are other members of the African-American community who are also going through those experiences with me. So I was able to develop a very, very close group of friends who were able to recognize we came from a similar background, going through similar experiences, and we ultimately had a similar trajectory where we wanted to go. We have interests. We each came from small, relatively small towns, but we're interested in bettering ourselves. We're going to get through this experience together. Well, that's really what. So again, the diversity on campus is an issue, but there are pockets of individuals, and they're truly the individuals that I have met there. Again, friends for life in terms of life-changing experiences, and just always there for you. So it is. So I do have my own issues and reservations about the university, and I think they could definitely be doing more on the university front in terms of support services that they offer, ways that they can really go into the community and support the students that they have there, because it truly is a jarring experience at first for many first-year students when they're placed in this predominantly white environment, and you're struggling to adjust. When you struggle to adjust socially, it oftentimes it plays out in your academics, it plays out in your social, and ultimately affects the overall retention rate of those students. And unfortunately, a lot of students aren't able to acclimate and say they'll choose the university. So I really wish the university could do more along those lines, because there are those individuals, and I really wish that there are those individuals that are willing to reach out and help those students. I just really wish the university put more funding and dollars towards that.
Got it. Great answer. And the mention of the pockets within the institution, it really is so true. You find your little group and you kind of stick it out together.
Yeah, now, yeah exactly.
Yeah. Now, Devin, I'm going to assume you had a very different experience.
I did.
Historically, institutions in the country. So what would you say about your experience?
Yeah, so funny enough, being from Philadelphia, I'm very familiar with both Villanova and grew up not too far from both of those institutions. And for me, I had a little bit different experience. I think, so just back about myself, K through 12, I went to independent school. So I was often one of one, two, maybe three African-American students in a grade. And then, you know, there were probably maybe 10 to 15 in a given section of a school, lower, middle, or upper. With that being said, I think what Jared said in terms of struggling to find yourself socially can often impact your overall grades. I felt as though I wasn't necessarily performing as well as I should have in the classroom, especially during my high school years, and wanted a place that, you know, allowed me to feel comfortable in both, you know, my environment and also, you know, in who I am and how I could grow as an individual. And so that was kind of the decision behind going to an HBCU in the first place. None of my other classmates were even considering HBCUs, but for me, it was about comfort and being able to grow as an individual. And so going down to Morehouse, it was definitely an adjustment from going to independent schools. It wasn't, you know, the same as being one of three Black kids in a grade. It was, oh, everyone looks like me. This is pretty cool. But at the same time, it was also an adjustment for the first year or so. I think that the nice part about Morehouse is that once you find your pocket of friends, as Jared mentioned, you can really figure out sort of how you can align with those individuals to help each other grow and get to the points where you want to be. That is one of the key features about Morehouse, is that once you find that crew and that group, as we put it, you can really grow with them throughout your 4 years. And so my, you know, group of six, seven guys are still friends to this day. We talk every day in our group chat. I live with, my roommate was one of those six guys in New York. And I think that is kind of the nice feature about it. The other great experience that I had at Morehouse was, you know, pledging Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. So joining that organization as a junior, so spring 2017, was a great experience for me. I went on to be chapter president. I was also the Southern Region Brother of the Year, so the number one ranking college brother in the organization in the Southern Region. And did a bunch of other stuff with that organization that really helped me grow as an individual. But I think overall, Morehouse was the best decision for me. The network is extremely powerful. The experience is very powerful. And just the overall environment and atmosphere is a great environment for an African-American male. So,
excellent. Good to hear. So a quick stat break. HBCUs make up only 3% of the country's colleges and universities, but enroll 10% of all African-American students and produce almost 20% of all African-American graduates. Do you feel, though, that coming from an HBCU, you were prepared to enter into a predominantly white workforce, or was that transition kind of stark coming back in?
And so I think that that's an excellent question. It's a question that me and my close friends talk about all the time. I think that I was fortunate enough to go to predominantly white schools for the majority of my educational career, which allowed me to assimilate into a white culture quite quickly. And to become acclimated in a rapid fashion. Whereas I think a lot of my Morehouse classmates had difficulties going to a predominantly white corporate America environment. I think that you see kids who come from, you know, predominantly Black schools, K through 12, and go to a Morehouse and then enter corporate America and often just get lost. They don't know how to connect with people who don't look like them. They don't understand how to really leverage your resources and leverage those who are above you. And oftentimes there aren't really many African-Americans in more senior positions than that analyst role. And so I think it is a very difficult jump to make from an HBCU to corporate America, especially just given the demographics of a lot of these large financial services institutions. With that being said, I think that Morehouse prepared me in all the ways possible to really learn how to present myself, hold my head high at all times, and really, you know, be able to connect with people on a deeper relationship level than just work. And I think that Morehouse does a great job of helping you with the qualitative aspects of being a professional. And that is something that is extremely crucial when entering a corporate America environment, whether you're Black or white. And so that, I think, is a differentiating factor between those who get promoted to associate and those who don't, is being able to be, you know, acclimated with other individuals, being personable, being able to relate. And Black versus white, you have to be able to do that. And I think that Morehouse did a great job of preparing me to do that. And, you know, I think that is the benefit of an HBCU, is they really teach you how to be confident, present well, be well-spoken, well-dressed, all the things that you need to make a positive impression. And then you kind of have to handle the last component, which is working hard and working and doing the right thing. So I think I was prepared.
Okay, great. And then Jared, I had an experience a little more similar to yours in coming from the first school before college, mm-hmm. and all of you kind of when getting to college, trying to find to get through the day. Do you feel that coming from diverse schools at a younger age and then going into the less diverse school help prepare you for corporate America?
I would probably say yes, because coming from, so during high school, I went to public school, and that was, that was an experience in of itself, from the type of people you meet, and then going to from public high school to a private college. But I guess really just being able to interact with people from all different types of backgrounds, it really does, I believe as though it really does create the ability to, what Devin said, just be able to relate to individuals. I think that's a key focus of what is often missed in how to navigate one career, is that you really do have to find a way to connect with individuals, connect with them, because it really, there are so many, it's relationship business. And that people want to work with individuals who they enjoy speaking with. They want to work with individuals that rely on, they can count on, that they're personable, easy to speak with. And it's really just how do you go about connecting with individuals, and how do you go about what are ways in which you can relate with individuals. So I do think there are situations that that I went through during my high school years that allowed me to much more easily connect with individuals. And in my professional setting now, I work with individuals who have kids that are going to public school now. And it's like, hey, how do I navigate the college process with a guidance counselor who may not necessarily be totally plugged into my child's success? And that's something that you really have to take and say, hey, like, as you really need to take ownership of this, and you say, hey, don't let this individual tell you you can't go somewhere. Like, you really have to be able to overcome and say, hey, this, I know what I'm capable of. I can see myself succeeding in this environment and really pushing past those. And if I hadn't done that, I probably would not have ended up at Villanova, and I probably wouldn't have ended up in a corporate position like I am today. So I really think it really did build on a level of fortitude in myself, and I really think it does. It has been a strength for me.
Excellent. All right. Now, in terms of preparation for the career educationally, I heard you both say majors that are finance, math, economic related. Do you think the preparation for your position came from having that major? And I say that because we have a running joke in law that law school doesn't prepare you for a corporate career, especially in finance. It prepares you to be a litigator and, you know, handle cases. Do you feel that your majors helped, or is it completely different from what you do on a day-to-day?
Sure, I'll answer that one first. I think that my major definitely helped. I think being a finance major gave me the background and the background knowledge and information necessary to succeed in my job. However, I do think that there's a certain element of learning that happens when you complete internships and actually start full time. So I think that it was nice to have the background information, the theories, the lessons that you get from the textbooks, but at the same time, having three distinct internships are what really taught me the backbone and the necessary knowledge to succeed in finance. And I think that's kind of the case for a lot of individuals. I think for me specifically, having an internship at my junior summer at least provided the additional reinforcements necessary to transition into a full-time role as a first-year analyst. And yes, the Morehouse curriculum and educational background really did help prepare me for that. But I think that each job is very unique and very different, and you won't actually learn those specific skills that pertain to that role until you get there. And that was the case, the situation for me was that, yes, it was great understanding, what the different accounting principles, financial statements, things of that nature, and how those affect the business. But at the end of the day, the valuation, the modeling, the things of that nature, I learned on the job. And I think that that's kind of the way that a lot of financial services jobs operate is, yes, you have the base knowledge or the background knowledge, but then you learn everything on the desk. So that was my experience.
Okay, good. So what I take from that is that real life experience is really what's key beyond the major.
Exactly.
Great. And Jared?
Yeah, I would definitely echo a lot of that in terms of what I picked up during my undergrad experience. It was definitely very good from a foundational sense, and a lot of the theories would help with a lot of context. So I think for me, it was extremely helpful when talking with individuals, learning the context, and making sound, you can come across as more confident, and you're able to learn quicker. Right? You realize there are some very unique situations that happen in the corporate world that you wouldn't really be able to cover in a class that's really approaching from a broad sense. So really, that foundational knowledge is really what allows you to acclimate and pick up on knowledge on a much quicker basis. And I really think that's what separates the members of a class. So you have individuals who are, it's really the speed at which you're able to take in new information, learn it, and then really apply it to your day-to-day. Yes, my major was helpful in like a theoretical sense, but in terms of like what Devin said, like learning on the job is where you'll learn 6 months. In 6 months on the job, you'll probably learn more than like a full year of a class. Just the nature of the industry. It's like trial by fire. But you get through it, and you're better for it.
All right, good to hear. So we actually had an audience question in preparation. We didn't say who our guests were. We just said they were finance professionals. But one of our followers on Instagram, Andrea Eli, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, she sent a DM saying she failed math twice. Does this mean she probably shouldn't consider a career in finance and should try something else?
Jerry? Yeah, I would necessarily say no. I would definitely want to ask which level of math, like, because there are much levels. If she's talking about like differential equations and in calculus, like, okay, like I understand that. So then I'd say definitely still try a hand at finance, but definitely I also say don't let that discourage you though. Don't let that discourage you. If you're really willing to put in the time, effort to learn and really articulate what it is about math that in a classroom setting or in a test setting that you struggle with, but you're able to actually actively demonstrate that you're able to do quick calculations in your head, you're able to consistently grasp financial concepts, I wouldn't necessarily totally let that discourage or dissuade you. I think what it does highlight is a need for maybe a level of perspective. Right, so maybe just to think about why, what are the issues around math, and maybe what is it that she really wants to do, right? Like, what is the reason that she's interested in pursuing a career in finance, right? Finance isn't the only career out there. There are plenty of other ways. So it's not necessarily, so I think for me, my biggest thing I would say to her is to really look inward on herself and really think about what is it that she wants to do and why. Because if it's really important to ask those hard questions earlier on, as opposed to her pushing forward. So I have to do finance. That's the only way. It's not. It's not the only way to achieve success. There are other ways. There are other interests that I'm sure that there are other careers out there. So I would really encourage her to go to take a hard look at herself.
Okay, great point, Devin. Anything you want to add?
I think Jared's answer was perfect. I think, you know, you shouldn't really, failing a class, you know, once or twice shouldn't dissuade you from pursuing your passions or your end goals. And so, you know, I think for her, it's really, like Jared said, a point in which she needs to reflect upon her ultimate trajectory and where she sees herself and what steps she can potentially take to get there and how she can, you know, fix these mistakes that may have been made, whether it's in the mathematics section or, you know, in history or whatever, and realize how you can grow upon that and figure out how to learn from your mistakes. And so that's kind of the only pieces of advice that I would have there. I think, you know, like I said earlier, you shouldn't be discouraged by any means. It should be a learning opportunity more so than anything else. I think that school is a time for you to learn and figure out what you're good at and not good at. And, you know, and even if you're not good at something, figure out ways that you can improve in that subject or that area. You have 4 years, maybe 5 years. And so, you know, with that being said, you should do your best to persevere and get over those humps. And, you know, there are bumps in everybody's road and everybody's path, but it's just about overcoming and getting to your ultimate destination. So that's my piece of advice.
Okay, great. Now, speaking of bumps, let's talk about college graduation rates, which is a big bump if you're trying to get finance. So Black males, 6-year college graduation rates hover around 40%. Black women are at around 49%, whereas white students average 69% and Asian students average 77%. For someone who has not graduated from college, whether because they failed out, didn't finish, maybe health reasons, any variety, do you think they have a chance in entering the corporate finance arena?
Oh, absolutely. I would definitely say there's definitely always a chance. I think it's really just important that for those individuals who have maybe paused their educational pursuits to really, one, if they are interested in career and finance, get back to the educational pursuits as soon as possible, because a bachelor's degree would be the minimum required for a lot of entry-level. But also be able to just come up with a cohesive narrative, a cohesive story. Things happen in people's lives. It's understandable. So I had to pause my education because I ran into health issues. I had to pause my education because I needed help out at home. I need to pause for a variety of different reasons. And as long as you're able to clearly articulate your rationale for pausing your education, I don't believe as though that should be a detriment to you ultimately entering career finance.
Okay.
Agreed. 100%. It was spot on. I think, like Jared said, there are bumps in everyone's road. Things happen, and there are times when people have to take off from school, whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, you know, but whatever your reason is, you need to make sure that you have a clear and concise and rational story behind it. Because like Jared said, for entry-level roles, usually a bachelor's degree is the minimum requirement. And at some point in time, you're going to have to go back to finish that degree in order to get into a lot of the corporate finance roles that you're looking to get into. But in the interview process, of course, that question is going to come up. Why did you take a, you know, however many year gap in your education? And as long as you have a reason, it can be for health reasons. It can be you had to support your family. It can be whatever it needs to be. But as long as you have a reason, a rationale, and an ultimate story behind it, I think that it should not be a factor that ultimately weeds someone out of a recruiting process. It should be something that you're confident in and understand, and you're the person who understands why you had to do it. And if you can explain that to a recruiter, then I think that you should be more than eligible for a role within any corporate finance position or firm.
Okay, excellent. And I just wanted to clarify that, because there is a misconception that you need an MBA for a corporate finance career in certain degrees. So I'm glad that you both mentioned the minimum is a bachelor's, but you don't have to necessarily get 10 grad program degrees to enter. So excellent. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate all of our 2053 fam. And don't forget, know your worth.
The more you work for the man, the less you gonna make. Harder you work for someone else, the more taxes you pay. Don't forget that lifestyle taxes keep us regulated. Have to make sure to keep our people educated. Solution to work smarter, not harder. Break the cycle and live unbothered. Turn income to wealth for our sons and our daughters. Apply to school without feeling too broke to go to college. Cause we're not making what 2/3 of these parents would make. That's with no degree and trust funds that parents create. That can be you, just tune in and then you're on your way. When the time comes, tell me what they gon' say. Started from the bottom, got a slow start. Now we're getting educated, trying to spend our money smart. Let's prove this news, that's all so sad. And make sure by 2053 it's not happening. Started from the bottom, got a slow start. Now we're getting educated, trying to spend our money smart. Let's prove this news, that's all so sad. And make sure by 2053 it's not happening. Money flow through us, not to us, let that sink in. Engage with people that always keep you thinking. Why people have the advantage, cause of position. But financial knowledge, it's our obligation. So we created the show, we just want you to know how to build your health and wealth and how to watch it grow. Tune into the pod and the YouTube channel. No network 2053, then that's a no.